start with something towards the beginning of the Sedra. The Rabbanu Shlom tells Moshe Rabbeinu, Re'ei Korosi B'Shem B'Tzalel Ben Uri Ben Hur. See, the Sfarno says many times that wherever the Torah says to see something and you can't see it with your physical eyes, it means to ponder, to think, to contemplate, his bonein. So therefore over here, obviously you can't see that God called the name of Bezalel, so it means think about it. Now how long can you think about the fact that the Rabbanu Shlom called the name of Bezalel? About 2 seconds. What is there to think deeply into? So I think perhaps the idea is the following. First you have to understand what a name is. In Lashon HaKodesh, the name of something represents its essence, its qualities, talents, abilities, capabilities. That's what's in the name. When Adam HaRishon was given the task to name all of the creations, including himself and the Rabbanu Shel Olam, it wasn't just arbitrary. But he called them in Lashon HaKodesh names that represented their essence physically, spiritually, emotionally, on many, many different levels. Chazal say that every person has 4 names. The name HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives you, the name that your parents give you, the name that your friends give you, and the main name is the one that you make for yourself. The way I understand that, based on this idea of shame, of the name being the essence of the person, in fact, the essence of the word neshama, the inner letters of neshama is shem, his name. That's the inner essence of a thing. The inner essence of his neshama is its name. So you have many talents, abilities, capabilities, and qualities. Some of them are given to you directly by HaKadosh Baruch Hu when he created your neshama. Every neshama is different. Every neshama has a tafkid in this world. And when you're created, your neshama was created, it was created with the qualities that will enable it to fulfill its tafkid in this world. Some people have one kind of quality, other qualities, different kinds of character traits, and so on. That's the name HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives you. There are some qualities, though, that were not given to you at the time that your neshama was created, but they're given when you're born. Those are qualities that you get from heredity. That's a name your parents give you. And then there are qualities that you're not born with, but that you learn throughout your life from others. That's the name your friends give you. All of those names are potential. Potential is like a big zero. If you have a lot of potential, you have a lot of zeros. Still remain zero. But if you put something in front of those zeros, the more zeros, the bigger the number. If you put nothing in front of it, it remains zero. That's potential. Potential is something that if you realize it and do something with it, then the potential is meaningful. If you do nothing with it, then the potential is meaningless. So that's the name you make for yourself. Taking all that potential and realizing it and actualizing it, that's the Iker name that a person has. So that's what a name is. And I don't remember if way back in the beginning of the year I mentioned this, but I mentioned it again anyway. How important is it that a person realize and actualize his potential and bring out and use his character traits, his abilities, capabilities, and talents? It says that at Me'ila on Yom Kippur, we don't have time for the long Al-Chait Vidui, so we skip it. And in its place, we substitute 3 paragraphs that start, Atan Nosin Yad LaPosher. The Baruch Hashem, you stretch out your hand to sinners and try to enable them to return. In those 3 paragraphs, there is one sin that we confess. No others. One. L'manechtal me'oshek yodeinu. In order that we should stop stealing. Says the Chedushei Arim, the Ger Rebbe, is that the only sin that the Jewish people have to confess ni'il of Yom Kippur every year? Men, women, children? We're all a bunch of ganovim? That's the sin that all Jews are guilty of. We're all a bunch of robbers and thieves. So we have to confess we're going to stop stealing? What does it mean? So he says the following. Before I tell you what he says, I'll give you a marshal. In the secular high school, it's acceptable that scouts from various sports teams or firms come to scout out talented seniors and offer them to go to their institution and give them scholarships or whatever. If they see that they're very talented and they want students with those talents. Also, firms come and who want eventually to have, for instance, a talented young woman who is talented in art and in mathematics. She scores the highest grades on her math exams, and she's very talented artistically. She would make a great engineer if she went and learned engineering. Put those two things together, you have a great engineer. So a scout from a firm, an engineering firm, approach her, and they say, we see that you excel in the talents that's necessary to make a good engineer. Maybe we can convince you to want to become an engineer. And in order to do that, we are willing to pay for your entire college education. We're willing to pay your room and board, give you spending money, and give you a guaranteed job when you graduate and get your degree. One condition, that you commit yourself to work 5 years for our firm. We need young, talented engineers. We think you could really be somebody special. We're willing to invest in you. No, so she signs on the dotted line. She gets her entire education payroll, room and board, spending money throughout her years in college. And finally, she gets her degree. She becomes an engineer. She comes to work for the firm. And instead of doing anything constructive, the entire day she plays computer games. That's it. What sin is she guilty of? No? Stealing. She's a thief. They invested a lot of money in her with one condition, that she give them a return on their investment by working for the firm. And she is wasting her time. She's not working for the firm. She's not giving them a return on their investment. She's a thief. Says the Chedushei Arim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu invested in us a lot more than money. He gave us a neshama, a body, talents, abilities, capabilities, material possessions, and all he wants to see is a return on his investment. He'd like to see us use what he gave us in his service. And we come to Eil of Yom Kippur, and we look back on the year, and we see that not only aren't we always using what God gave us for his sake, many times we're using it for the competition. So we're a bunch of thieves. So we tell the Rabbanim, from this year we're going to stop stealing. We're going to start using what you gave us in your service, so we'll give you a return on your investment. That's what it means, l'manechta me'oshik yodeinu. So a person was given talents, abilities, capabilities, and is expected to use it in service of the Rabbanim Shalom. That's exactly what we learn from the Tzala. Re'ei karasi b'shein b'tzalot. Look, think, ponder. Think deeply. I called the name of B'tzalot. B'tzalot was a very talented young man. He was an architect, a builder, a jeweler, a tremendous Talmud Chacham, a Kabbalist. He knew how to put the letters together with which HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world. He was an artist. He was very, very talented. Where did he get all these talents? Learned them in school. He was an avid his entire life. So where did he get these talents? Obviously, God gave them to him. They're God-given talents. That's the first thing to ponder. Every human being, especially every Jew, is given talents, abilities, capabilities. Everybody has something special about them. And you may not think that it's very special, but you have a talent, an ability, a capability, whatever it may be. Something you can do that you excel in. And you don't know who is more important or less important or what that talent could accomplish throughout your lifetime. And it doesn't have to look extremely impressive, because sometimes things that aren't all that impressive are really the important things in this world. You know, a young woman went to take a bath one morning, and she saw a little basket floating in the water, and she decided to be a nice person and save the little baby inside. And I'm sure if she would have gone home that day, and somebody would have said, Basio Basparo, you fulfilled your tachlis today. She said, what are you talking about? I saved a little baby. It was a nice thing to do, but, you know, it's not one of the more impressive things in this world. But obviously it was. Looking back, that was a pretty hefty, important thing to do. So you never know who you can impress, who you can help, that may make an eternal, universal difference in this world. So, you don't know what talent you specifically have, who you can influence, who you can make an effect on, that may be something that eternally is important. So every person has special, unique talents, abilities, capabilities, just like Bitzvah. They're given to you by God. Second lesson. Why do you think HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Bitzvah those tremendous talents? In order that he should build townhouses, shopping centers, maybe. I don't know if Bitzvah did in his spare time. But it's obvious that somebody had to build the Mishkan, and the Rabbanu Shalom provided with Bitzvah with the wherewithal to build the Mishkan. Second lesson, if you have talents, abilities, capabilities, you can use them for anything. But they were given to you predominantly to be used in service of the Rabbanu Shalom. That is the purpose of them. The icing on the cake is you could use them for other purposes too. But the main thing is to use them in service of the Rabbanu Shalom. That's why they were given. So that is what Ve'ei Karasi B'Shem B'Tzalel. Look, think. I called the name of Bitzvah. I invested in him. Tremendous talents. And I did it, obviously, as you build a Mishkan. So learn from that you're the same. God invested in each and every one of us, maybe not the same talents as a Bitzvah, but similar. And he expects us to use it in his service. Okay. Next. Any questions on this? No, we'll go to something else. Yes. Right. But so we say Oshamnu, and we say the whole day Al Faith, but when it comes to Ne'ilah, we want to get down to the brass tacks. What's the major point in everything? Right? All the sins that we do basically come from the fact that we don't realize that we've been put in this world and given the wherewithal to use what we have to serve Hashem. And if we don't realize that, then we end up doing all these other averes. So that is, to a certain degree, the root of everything else. Okay, any other questions on this? Okay, let's go on. When the people thought that Moshe Rabbeinu was no longer alive, or that he disappeared into the heavens and he wasn't coming back, because they miscalculated the 40 days that he said he was going to be on Har Sinai. So they went to look for a replacement for Moshe Rabbeinu. According to many Rishonim, that was the Chet HaEgel. They were not so foolish to think that they were creating a God that took them out of Egypt, which is absurd. If they just created that God, how could it have taken them out of Egypt? What they were looking for is a replacement for Moshe Rabbeinu, and that's what the Pasuk says. Ku ma'aseh lanu Elohim, make us a power. The word Elohim does not mean a God. Elohim means a power. Elohim can mean an angel. Elohim can mean a judge. Or any power. And that's why Elohim Acherim means other powers that people make into gods. There aren't other gods, but there are other powers. So Elohim, that's why it's the plural, even when it refers to the Ribbono Shel Olam, because the Ribbono Shel Olam is the source of all those powers. That's a plural. And there are many powers in the world. So that's what they wanted. Kum asei lanu Elohim, make us a power, asher yel chulifanenu, that will walk before us. Why? Ki zem Moshe ha'ish lo yadanu mehayolo. We don't know what happened to this man, Moshe. So we need somebody to take his place. They didn't say we don't know what happened to God, so we need somebody to take his place. So why is that Avodah Zarah? Because that's what Avodah Zarah is. Avodah Zarah is creating something that you think that you can worship, manipulate, and in that way gain success. Some power in the world that you think will bring you success if you manipulate it, and in that way you will channel, direct, control various powers that God put in the world. Didn't you believe in God? There's absolutely no difference between a Mishkan that harnesses various spiritual powers and enables us to use the various kalim to direct those powers into the world. The menorah directs the power of learning, and the shulchan, the power of parnasa. There's no difference between a golden building or a golden table or a golden candelabra and a golden calf. There's only one difference between them, because that's what they wanted, the golden calf. The Ramban says they took the power of Parnassa, which is represented by the Pnei Hashor, the face of the ox on God's throne. That represents the power of Parnassa that the Ramban shall put in the world. Rov Tvuos, the Koach Shor, the shore represents plowing, planting, creating sustenance. And that's what they needed in the desert. So they stole that power to direct it in order they should be able to use that eagle as a receiving station for that power that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put in the world and direct themselves Parnassa in the desert. That's what they needed. What's the difference between that and a shulchan where we put bread on the shulchan to direct the powers of Parnassa to the world? There's only one difference. One of them God said to do, and one we did on our own. If you do it on your own, it's Avodah Zarah. If the Ribbono Shel Olam tells you to do it, that's fine. Then you're serving the Ribbono Shel Olam in the way he told you to do it. If he sets up the relationship, then that's fine. If you create the relationship, it's Avodah Zarah. And if you understand that, or don't understand that, then anything could become Avodah Zarah. Even the Mishkan, even Talmud Chacham can become Avodah Zarah. If you think that you are creating a connection and not the way the Ribbono Shel Olam wants it connected. Somebody once told me a story that one of the relatives of Rav Sholem Shvadron Zatzal was at the Kosel on Shabbos, and he saw an Israeli writing a tefillah on Shabbos and putting it in the wall. So he figured the guy has some deathly ill person at home, and he figures that it's b'tuach nefesh, you're allowed to write a kvittel to save his life. So he went over to me and said, what are you doing? It's Shabbos. You have somebody sick at home that you want to put in a tefillah, and you think that it's okay to write on Shabbos for that? He said, no, I'm the captain of an Israeli soccer team, and we have a championship match this week, and I put in a wish to the wall that we win. That's Avodah Zarah. Right, there's no difference between that and mirror, mirror on the wall, or wall, wall on the ground. Right? If it's a wishing wall, that the wall will do your bidding, if you put a little piece of paper in, it will fulfill your wishes, right? Like a wishing well. So that's Avodah Zarah. The idea of the Beis HaMikdash is the Shechinah is there. And the Ribbono Shel Olam said, I want you to make this connection. But if you think it's a wishing wall, it's Avodah Zarah. So that was the sin. The sin was they wanted a replacement of Moshe Rabbeinu. They asked that a few questions. This is not really what I want to speak about, but we'll enhance the idea. They asked, if they wanted a replacement for Moshe Rabbeinu, why did they have to make an Egel Hazav? Why didn't they ask Aaron to take Moshe's place? He was pretty much a good replacement. Why didn't they ask Nachshon ben Aminadab? Why didn't they ask Hur? There were people who could have taken Moshe Rabbeinu's place. Why do they want to make an Egel Hazav? So one very practical answer, they say, is that they were afraid to take another human being, because they saw human beings are very frail and vulnerable, because it's Moshe Rabbeinu, like, you know, just disappeared. So we don't want another human being. We want something a little bit more durable, a little bit more permanent. So something made out of gold is a lot more durable and permanent than a human being. So they decided to harness this power that's represented by the Egel Hazav, to harness the power of Parnassa. And if that sounds strange, let me tell you what you can compare it to. Somebody builds a little box like this, okay, like one of these, and he'll tell you that he can harness with that sound waves, and it'll play music that he gets from the air, a radio. But it has to be built a certain way, with certain circuits and certain what's it called, crystals or whatever it is that they make things today with. And if you turn it on properly, right, and you tune it to the right station, you will get music. If you tune it to a different station, you get the news. Tune it to a different station, you get sports. Right? And it has to be built. It's a physical thing, built a certain way, yet it attracts various spiritual energy and plays it. So what's so hard to understand? If you make a golden calf and you know how to make it with the right circuits or whatever, that it will attract the powers of Parnassa that the Rabbanim will put in the higher world and bring it down here, that you'll be able to manipulate it and make Parnassa. But if you're doing it on your own, that's Avodah Zarah. You're creating a power that you think you need to manipulate and serve in order to get success. The Vilna Gaon says along those lines, the Avodah Zarah today is money. Because people think that money is something that if you manipulate it properly, it will give you power and you'll be able to be successful. So they make it into a god. And they do exactly what people do to the other gods. They sacrifice their children, their families, themselves, their health, in order to earn more money. And it becomes a mamash and avodah zarah, an obsession. So that's what they wanted, right? So therefore, they wanted something more permanent, more durable. That's one shot. Then they say, tongue-in-cheek, the following. They say that this is the nature of the Jewish people, or for that matter, probably any people. It is more attractive to get a golden calf from out of town than an Aaron HaKohen that you know already who's in town. Right? Meaning that if you want to excite people about a project or whatever, you have to bring in a speaker from out of town, even though the people in town may be much greater than the person you're bringing in from out of town. I find this all the time on both sides. Right? In my own community, right, sometimes I have trouble getting a minyan for a shiur. But if I go to other communities, the people turn out in droves. Somebody recently said, oh, it's too bad that Rabbi Lev can't be here every week. I said, if I was here every week, you wouldn't be here. So it's attractive to somebody that you're not familiar with, right? That's the calling card. So it's better to have an Egel HaZahav from the outside than an Aaron HaKohen from the inside. They ask another question, and that is, when they thought that Moshe Rabbeinu was dead at this juncture, they went and made parties, eating, drinking, dancing. And when Moshe Rabbeinu actually died, they mourned for him for 30 days. Somebody once asked the Brisker Rav this question. Why, when they thought Moshe Rabbeinu was dead, did they go and make a party? And when they actually died, they mourned him. So Brisker Rav said like this. He said that a chassid once asked him a similar question, and now he has an answer to that question. So the chassid once asked him, why, when we have a yahrzeit for one of our rebbes, we make a hilula, we make a kiddush, you know, what's it called, and we make a l'chaim, and we eat, and when you, Litvak, have a yahrzeit for one of your gedolim, you fast, it says in the Shulchan Aruch, you're supposed to fast, or whatever, why do you fast, and we make a l'chaim, and eat? He said, now that answers your question is the answer to the other question. So why, when they thought Moshe Rabbeinu was dead, they went and ate and drank, and when he actually died, they made a, what's it called, a mourning. He said like this. He said when they thought Moshe Rabbeinu was dead, they hadn't yet gotten any Torah from him. They didn't learn anything from him. So Moshe Rabbeinu's gone. Okay, so, you know, we'll make a l'chaim. But after 40 years of learning Torah from Moshe Rabbeinu, and now he was gone, now was something to mourn about. He said, that answers your question also, which we won't go into detail right now. I'm sure there is a Hasidish version of that joke, which is a little different, probably. In any case, so that's what they wanted. They wanted a replacement of Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, I'll get to what I wanted to say. But the job description was different than the way Moshe Rabbeinu made his job description later on. What did they say? We want someone to take Moshe's place, because we don't know what happened to him, and what should this thing do? Asher yelchu lefaneinu. We want it to walk in front of us, to go in front of us. When Moshe Rabbeinu, before he died, asked the Ribbono Shel Olam to provide a substitute, a successor to him, he described his job in the following way. Yifkod Hashem Elokei Aruchos Ish Al Ho'eda. Kadosh Baruch Hu should appoint. Kadosh Baruch Hu knows the spirit of everybody. Should appoint someone over the Eda. Asher Yetzei Lifneihem V'Asher Yovel Lifneihem. Who'll go out from them and come back to them. Asher Yotzi'em V'Asher Yivi'em. Who will bring them out and bring them in. Not Asher Yelchu Lifneihem. Who'll go in front of them. But go out from them, come back to them, bring them out, bring them in. What's the difference between those two descriptions of Moshe Rabbeinu's job? The people understood that Moshe Rabbeinu was supposed to do it for them. He goes in front of us, and he'll do it. He's a trailblazer. And Moshe Rabbeinu understood that that's not the purpose of a leader. To illustrate it, let me tell you the following machlokas. The Gemara says that if someone has, Rachmana Litzlan, someone sick in their house, so they should go to a chacham, and he should and he should daven and ask for mercy for that person who's sick. So the Nemuke Yosef explains the Gemara very simply. What it means is you go to a chacham and he will daven for the sick person. He said that's why the custom is in Germany that on Shabbos they make the Shabbos for the cholim, like we do. Why? Because all the Talmid HaChacham come to Shul on Shabbos, and when they make the Mishnah Berurah, they'll answer Amen, and that way you're Mekayim this idea that if you have somebody sick, go to a Chacham, he'll daven for the person who's sick. So here we have a chance to let the Chachamim daven for these sick people. The Meiri says a completely different understanding of that Gemara. He says the following: if you have someone sick in your house, you should go to a chacham, and he'll teach you how to daven for that sick person. The chacham is not going to daven for you. He's going to teach you how to do it. Now, it could be there's no argument. It could be that the Mukhi Yosef also agrees. The ideal is he should teach you how to daven. But until he'll teach you to daven, the guy may die. So until he teaches you, he'll daven for you. The chacham has no direct line to God more than any of us. Every Jew has a direct line to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Except, what does the Chacham know more? He knows how to dial. Sometimes you can have a direct line, you don't know how to dial. You don't know how to use the phone. You don't know how to talk properly. So the Chacham knows. So he can make the connection, and he can talk properly, he knows what to say. But he's no different than you. All you need to know is how to do it. So he'll teach you how to be the kind of person that he is, who knows how to make the connection, who knows how to talk, and who has a member of the calling institution that he can make a call. So you have to have certain needles also. So he'll teach you all of that. The Chacham will teach you. He's not supposed to do it for you. He's supposed to teach you how to do it. Until he can do that, he'll daven for you. But that's not the goal. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu said. I'm not somebody who's Yale Kulik Nehem, walks in front of them and does it for them. I'm somebody who goes out from amongst them and gives them something to copy, to emulate, is an example. And sometimes that's not good enough. That's only good for people who want to follow the example. Then if you go out from them and come back to them, they'll follow your example. But if you're not, the people that you're leading don't want to be inspired, don't want to follow example, then Asher Yotzi'ein v'Asher Yivi'ein. Sometimes you have to schlep them by the neck and bring them out and put them back in. And teach them almost by force how to do what they're supposed to do. But that's the role of a leader. The leader is not supposed to do it for you. He's supposed to teach you how to do it, ultimately. That's the difference between how Moshe Rabbeinu described his job and how the people described it by the Chet HaEgel. Just one interesting point by the Chet HaEgel. The way I described to you what they did is that they hijacked the power that was in the Rabban Shem's throne, the four faces. One of them is the face of an ox, which is the power of Parnassa. So they stole that power and manipulated it for their own purposes. Okay. So the Vilna Gaon explains with that the following. It says that when the Rabban Shem brought a plague on the people who served the Egel, how many people died? Kishloshes alfeish, about 3,000 people. So the Vilna Gaon says that contradicts a medrash. It's mashma that there were 3,000 people who actually served Avodah Zarah out of 600,000. Right, that's a 0.5%. So 0.5% or less than that. 3,000, yes, 0.5%. Pretty small amount, yeah? So, still, the Vilna Gaon says that's not what the Medrash says. The Medrash says on the Pasuk in Koheles, Ish achas me'elef matzasi, ve'isha achas lo matzasi. I found one man in 1,000 and no women. So the Medrash says it's going on the Chet HaEgel. By the Chet HaEgel, one out of every 1,000 sinned by the men, and no women sinned. Not one woman sinned by the Chet HaEgel. And men, only one out of 1,000. Now, if you make a cheshbon, if there were 600,000 men between 20 and 60, and only one out of 1,000 sinned, how many sinned? 600. So why does the Torah say that 3,000 people died if only 600 sinned? Says the Vilna Gaon that when a person steals an ox and he sells it or he shechts it, right? So the halacha is you have to pay back 5 times the value of the ox. That means if 600 people sinned, but their sin was stealing that spiritual ox, so how many times do you have to pay back? 5 times. 5 times 600 is 3,000. That doesn't mean that 3,000 people died. It doesn't say shloshes alfeish. It says kishloshes alfeish. 600 died, but they were considered like 3,000 since you had to pay back 5 times. So, in a nutshell, that was the Chet HaEgel, and that was the difference between how the people saw Moshe Rabbeinu's job, the job of a leader, and how Moshe Rabbeinu understood what the job of a leader is. Okay. Next. Any questions on this? Yes.
Do you also have to think about, by the angel, they were, disappointing because they hadn't gotten the Torah from Moshe, but,
Right. That was, I don't think that was a serious word. It was just to get a little bit out that chassid. The real answer to the question is a good question. I don't know 100% what the real answer is. The real answer was that when they were following the Yetzer HaTov, you mourn for Moshe Rabbeinu. When they were following the Yetzer Hara, then they got carried away with the with their new leader that they made. So that's the Yetzer Hara. If it's a Yetzer Hara, it becomes too good and too enjoyable. The Satmar Rebbe says that it says in the Medrash, "Vayar Elokim es kol asher asa v'hinei tov ma'od." Tov ze yetzer hatov. Ma'od ze yetzer hara. Simple meaning, the world would be a good place if there was only a yetzer hatov. But it's a very good place because there is a yetzer hara and you have a choice. That makes it very good. That's a simple meaning. The Satmar Rebbe said, tongue in cheek, Tov, if something is good, it could be the yetzer hatov. But if it's very good, it must be the yetzer hara. Right? Too good already, it's not the yetzer hatov anymore. So, when it's good, and you, Moshe Rabbeinu's really not there, and you're following yetzer hatov, you mourn for him. But when you're making your own God, and your own successor, and it's very good, then you rejoice. Okay. Any other questions on this? Okay, let's go on. Moshe Rabbeinu hears from the Rabbanu Shel Olam exactly what's going on at the foot of Har Sinai. Right, soru maher min aderech asher tzivisem osu lahem egel masecha. Right, they sacrifice to it, and they're what's it called, and they're worshiping it, and he doesn't do anything. He doesn't break the luchos. The reason he broke the luchos, according to one opinion at least, is because the luchos were the bris between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Klal Yisrael. It's like the ring that creates the marriage, the physical entity. And if Klal Yisrael were serving another power and they were considered married to Hashem, it's like a married woman committing adultery. So Moshe Rabbeinu broke the luchos as if to say they're not married yet. They haven't created that bond, and therefore the sin is less of a sin. It's not like a married woman, it's like an unmarried woman. So if that's the case, as soon as he heard what was doing, he should have broken the luchos. Why did he wait till he came down? So some say that hearing the sin was one thing, but by Yaris HaMacholos, he saw them dancing and singing, then he said there's no hope for them. You know, if they did the sin and they have a heavy heart about it is one thing, but they're rejoicing in the sin, then there's no hope, so you got to break the luchos. The Sefer HaIkarim, Zerisha, Rabbi Yosef Albo, says a different shot, which is very, very significant, b'chlal, to Shmir Satorah. He says that even Moshe Rabbeinu is a human being. What affects us in this world is what we see with our five senses. And even if you know something, you know it intellectually, but you don't see it with your five senses, does not make the same impression. Even if the Rabbanu Shel Olam describes for you what's happening, you believe it. But it doesn't make the same impression as when you see it with your own two eyes. Not because you believe it more, but because now you feel it. Because we're human beings and we are affected by what we sense with our senses. It's more real to us. And Telzer gave the example, I think we once mentioned it in a different context. You see a sign that says wet paint. What is the natural reflex action of most people to touch it and look at your finger? Don't you believe signs that paint is glistening? It's very obvious that it's wet paint. Why do you have to touch it and look at the paint on your finger? Because when you see it, it's intellectual. It's not sensory. And when you feel it and see it on your finger, it's more real. And therefore, even though the Rabbanu Shel Olam described for him, says the Sefer HaIkarim, what was happening, he knew it, but he didn't feel it till he saw it with his own eyes. And that's when he was moved to break the luchos. It wasn't an intellectual thing that moved him. It was a sensory thing, an emotional thing. And we are moved by our motions. Motions create emotions. We spoke about this. And that's why sometimes what you see makes more of an impression on what you know, even though it's not the really way it is. I'll give you two examples on both sides. Avraham Avinu went to Eretz Yisrael while his father was still alive. Terach did not die till after Yitzchak Avinu was born. Terach was at Yitzchak's bris. Figure it out how long Terach lived, how old Avraham Avinu was, how old Terach was when he had Avraham Avinu, and you can figure out how old Avraham was when Terach died. It wasn't 75, it was much later. So, but it says, Vayomas Terach the Quran, and then it says Lech Lecha. And the Medrash says, in order that people shouldn't say that Avraham Avinu left his old father and went on Aliyah? Should make a Chilul Hashem? So the Torah says that Terach died, and then it says Lech Lecha. The question is, that's very good for people who don't learn too much. But if you look into it and you make the cheshbonos, you can figure out very quickly that Terach's not dead. It just looks like that. So what did God gain? He gave us enough information to know that Terach wasn't really dead. But the answer is, that's intellect. But what you see when the Torah says, Vayomas Terach v'Charon and Lech Lecha, that's what you see, that's what makes more of an impression on you. The opposite way also. We know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu waited till the Makkah of Choshech to kill the Jews who were supposed to die and not leave Mitzrayim. Basically the ones who didn't want to leave, who felt Egyptian, assimilated, and weren't interested in leaving Mitzrayim. Okay? Not just the Rishayim, because over the Avodah Zorah left. Dalsam Naviram left. The people who felt that there was no reason to leave Mitzrayim, they were happy where they were. They stayed there. They couldn't stay there alive, so God killed them. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu, however, didn't want Paro to see Jews dying, because then he's going to say, hey, this is not just us, everybody's dying. So it's not just a mystery thing, it just happens to be a plague that affects everybody. See, Jews are dying too. So the Rabban Shem did it under the cover of darkness. During Makas Choshech, that's when the Jews died. Very nice. That would make sense if like 10 Jews died. So Paro would never know. They died under the guise of Choshech. They buried them, finished. But according to Chazal, 4/5 of the Jewish people died. Okay? That means before the lights went out, there were 3 million men between 20 and 60. And the lights go on, there's 600,000 left, and the cemeteries are full. It doesn't take too much of a chacham to figure out what happened. These people are not hiding under the bed, right? They're dead. There's a lot of graves. There's a lot of people were here. Now there are not a lot of people. Duh. Right. Guess what happened to them. So what in the world did the Rabban Shem gain by doing it in Choshech? When the lights went on, it became obvious. The answer is, if you see Jews dying, it makes an impression. If you deduce that Jews died, it doesn't make the same impression. And therefore, the Rabban Shem didn't want Paro to see it. He can deduce it, fine. But it's not going to make the same negative impression. Therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu did not break the luchos because he wasn't emotionally moved till he actually saw it himself. So says the Sefer Ikari. Okay. Okay, I think that will suffice. And we still have class next week, yeah? So next week we will have a chance, since it's Vayakel Pekudei, to go over the things that we skip in Truma and Tetzaveh, and we'll have a chance to, and maybe even in Kisisa, and have a second chance of filling them in. Okay.